Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Timescape by Gregory Benford, narrated by Simon Preble and Peter Bradbury. This work is copyrighted 1980 by Gregory Benford and Hilary Benford. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books. The year is 1962. JFK is still president, rock and roll is king, and something very strange is happening in Gordon Bernstein's lab at a California university. Someone is sending him a message that will alter history and uncover an incredible truth, the truth behind time itself. And now, Timescape.
Chapter 1. Spring 1998. Remember to smile a lot, John Renfrew thought moodily. People seem to like that. They never wondered why you kept on smiling, no matter what was said. It was a kind of general sign of goodwill, he supposed. One of the tricks he could never master.
Daddy, look, damn, watch out, Renfrew cried. Get that paper out of my porridge, will you? Marjorie, why are the bloody dogs in the kitchen while we're having breakfast?
Three figures in suspended animation stared at him. Marjorie, turning from the stove with a spatula in her hand, Nicky, raising a spoon to a mouth which formed an O of surprise. Johnny beside him, holding out a school paper, his face beginning to fall. Renfrew knew what was going through his wife's mind. John must be really upset. He never gets angry. Right. He didn't. It was another luxury they couldn't afford. The still photograph unfroze. Marjorie moved abruptly, shooing the yelping dogs out the back door. Nicky bowed her head to study her cook's cereal. Then Marjorie led Johnny back to his place at the table. Renfrew took a long, rustling breath and bit into his toast.
Don't bother Daddy today, Johnny. He's got a very important meeting this morning.
A meek nod.
I'm sorry, Daddy.
Daddy. They all called him Daddy. Not Pop, as Renfrew's father had wanted to be called. That was a name for fathers with rough hands who worked with caps on. Renfrew looked moodily round the table. Sometimes he felt out of place here, in his own kitchen. That was his son sitting there in a purse school uniform blazer, speaking in that clear upper-class voice. Renfrew remembered the confusing mixture of contempt and envy he had felt towards such boys when he was Johnny's age. At times he would glance casually at Johnny, and the memory of those times would come back. Renfrew would brace himself for that familiar, well-bred indifference in his son's face, and be moved to find admiration there instead.
I'm the one who should be sorry, lad. I didn't mean to shout at you like that. It's as your mother said, I'm a bit bothered today. So, what's this paper you wanted to show me, eh?
Well, they're having this competition for the best paper, Johnny began shyly, on how school kids can help clean up the environment and everything and save energy and things. I wanted you to see it before I give it in.
Renfrew bit his lips.
I haven't got time today, Johnny. When does it have to be in? I'll try and read it through tonight if I can.
Okay? Okay. Thanks, Daddy. I'll leave it here. I know you're doing frightfully important work. The English master said so.
Oh, did he? What did he say?
Well, actually, the boy hesitated. He said the scientists got us into this beastly mess in the first place, and they're the only ones who can get us out of it now, if anyone can.
He's not the first one to say that, Johnny. That's a truism.
Truism? What's a truism, Daddy? My form mistress says just the opposite.
Nicky came in suddenly.
She says the scientists have caused enough trouble already. She says God is the only one who can get us out of it, and he probably won't.
Oh, law. Another prophet of doom. Well, I suppose that's better than the primers and their back-to-the-stone-age rubbish, except that the prophets of doom stay around and oppress us all.
Miss Crenshaw says the primmies won't escape God's judgment either, however far they run,
Nicky said definitively.
Marjorie, what's going on in that school? I don't want her filling Nicky's head with ideas like that. The woman sounds unbalanced. Speak to the headmistress about her.
I doubt that would do much good, Marjorie replied equably. There are far more prophets of doom, as you call them, around than anyone else these days.
Miss Crenshaw says we should all just pray, Nicky went on obstinately. Miss Crenshaw says it's a judgment and probably the end of the world.
Well, that's just silly, dear, Marjorie said. Where would we all be if we just sat about and prayed?
You have to get on with things.
Speaking of which, you children had better get a move on, or you'll be late for school.
Miss Crenshaw says, consider the lilies of the field, Nicky muttered as she left the room.
Well, I'm no bloody lily, Renfrew said, pushing back his chair and rising. So I'd better go off and toil for another day.
Leaving me to spin, Marjorie smiled. It's the only way, isn't it? Here's your lunch. No meat again this week, but I've got a bit of cheese at the farm, and I pulled some early carrots. I think we may have some potatoes this year. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
She reached up and kissed him.
I do hope the interview goes well.
Thanks, love.
He felt the old familiar tightening begin. He had to get that funding. He put vast sums of time and thought into this project. He must have the equipment. It had to be tried. Renfrew left the house and mounted his bicycle. Already he was sloughing off the family man, his thoughts reaching ahead to the lab, the day's instructions to the technicians, the coming interview with Peterson. He pumped along, leaving Grantchester and skirting round Cambridge. It had rained during the night. A slight mist hung low over the ploughed fields, softening the light. Drops clung to the new green leaves on the trees. Moisture glittered on the carpet of bluebells covering the ground in the clearings. The lane here ran alongside a little stream lined by low alder bushes and nettles. On the surface of the stream, he could see ripples forming as the bugs called water boatmen jerked themselves along on their oar-like legs. Kingcups were blooming in a sheet of gold along the banks, and big, soft, furry catkins were coming out on the willows. It was a fresh April morning. The kind he had loved as a boy in Yorkshire, watching the mist rise off the moors in the pale morning sun and the hares scurry off at his approach. The lane he was cycling along had sunk deep over the years, and his head was nearly level with the tree roots on either side. A smell of damp earth and rain-washed grass came to him, mixed with an acrid tang of coal smoke. A man and a woman eyed him blankly as he pedalled by. They leaned idly against a sagging wood fence. Renfrew grimaced. Each month more squatters drifted into the area, thinking Cambridge was a rich town. Off to the right was the shambles of an old farmhouse. In the last week, the yawning black windows had been blocked in with newspaper, boards and rags. It was surprising squatters hadn't smelled out the place before. The last bit of cycling, nipping through the outskirts of Cambridge, was the worst. The streets were difficult to negotiate, with cars parked every which way, abandoned. There had been a national programme to recycle them, but all Renfrew had seen coming of it was a lot of talk on television. He threaded among the cars which sat there like eyeless, legless beetles, stripped of all their removable parts. Students were living in some of them. Drowsy faces turned to watch him wobble by. In front of the Cavendish, he locked his bicycle into the rack. One car in the lot, he noticed. Surely that bugger Peterson wasn't here this early. It wasn't yet 8:30. He trotted up the steps and across the entrance hall. To Renfrew, the present complex of three buildings was anonymous. The original Cav, where Rutherford had discovered the nucleus, was an old brick building in the centre of Cambridge, a museum. From the Maddingley Road, 200 metres away, this place could easily be taken for an insurance centre, or a factory, or any business place. When it had opened in the early 70s, the new Cav had been immaculate, with harmonised colour schemes, carpets in the library and well-stocked shelves. Now the corridors were poorly lit, and many laboratories yawned empty, stripped of equipment. Renfrew made his way to his own lab in the Mott building.
Good morning, Dr. Renfrew.
Oh, morning, Jason. Has anyone been in?
Well, George came in to start the roughing pumps, but...
No, I mean a visitor. I'm expecting a fellow from London.
Peterson's his name.
Oh, no, no one like that. You want me to get started here, then?
Yes, go ahead. How's the apparatus?
Fairly good. The vacuum is coming down. We're at 10 microns now. We've got a fresh charge of liquid nitrogen, and we've checked out the electronics. It looks as if one of the amplifiers is going. We're doing some calibrations, and the equipment should be checked in about an hour.
Okay. Look here, Jason. This fellow Peterson is coming down from the World Council. He's considering increasing funding. We'll have a run for him, put the apparatus through its paces in a few hours. Try to look lively and spruce the place up a bit, will you?
Right. I'll get her running.
Renfrew went down the catwalk to the floor of the laboratory and stepped nimbly over the wires and cables. The room was of bare concrete, outfitted with old-fashioned electrical connections and rather newer cables strewn through the aisles of apparatus. Renfrew greeted each of the technicians as he came to them, asking questions about the running of the ion focusers and giving his instructions. He knew this warren of equipment well now, had painfully gathered the pieces and designed it himself. The liquid nitrogen went tick and burbled in its flask. Powered units hummed in spots where there was a slight voltage mismatch. The oscilloscope's green faces danced and rippled with smooth yellow curves. He felt at home. Renfrew seldom noticed the austere walls and blocky angles of his lab. To him, it was a comfortable gathering of familiar elements working together. He couldn't fathom the now fashionable abhorrence of things mechanical. He suspected it was one side of a coin, the other being ore. But either was nonsense. One might as well feel the same emotions about a skyscraper, for example. Yet the building was no greater than a man. Men made it, not the other way around. The universe of artifacts was a human one. As Renfrew moved through the lanes of bulky electronics, he sometimes seemed to himself a fish swimming in the warm waters of his own ocean, carrying the elaborate scheme of the experiment as a multi-layered diagram in his mind, checking it against the never-perfect reality before him. He loved this thinking, correcting, and searching for the unseen flaw that could destroy the whole effect he wanted. He had assembled most of this apparatus by scavenging among the other research groups in the CAV. Research had always been a highly visible luxury, easily cut. The past 5 years had been a disaster. When a group had been shut down, Renfrew had salvaged what he could. He had started out in the nuclear resonance group as a specialist in making beams of high-energy ions. This became important in the discovery of a completely new kind of subatomic particle, the tachyon, which had been theorized about for decades. Renfrew had moved over into that field. He had kept his small crew afloat by adroit grantsmanship, and by using the fact that tachyons, as the newest of the new, had a clear intellectual claim to whatever funds remained in the National Research Council. The NRC had dissolved last year, though. This year, research was a puppet whose strings led to the World Council itself. The Western nations had pooled their research efforts in a gesture towards economy. The World Council was a political animal. To Renfrew, it seemed that the Council's policies boiled down to supporting highly visible efforts and little else. The fusion reactor program still got a lion's share, despite no apparent progress. The CAV's best groups, such as radio astronomy, had disbanded last year when the Council decided astronomy as a whole was impractical, and such work should be suspended for the duration. Precisely how long the duration might be was a point the Council neatly dodged. The idea was that as the present crisis deepened, the Western nations had to shuck off their research luxuries in favour of sweaty-browed concentration on the eco-problems and assorted disasters which dominated the newspaper headlines. One had to sail with whatever wind was blowing, Renfrew knew. He had managed to find a way that tachyons could have a practical purpose, and that slant had kept his group afloat so far. Renfrew finished calibrating some electronics gear. It was always going on the blink these days, and paused for a moment, listening to the preoccupied hum of the lab around him.
Jason, he called, I'm off to get coffee. Keep it all going, will you?
He picked up his old corduroy jacket off a hook and stretched mightily, showing crescents of sweat in the cloth around his armpits. In mid-stretch, he noticed two men on the platform. One of the technicians was pointing down at Renfrew, talking, and as Renfrew lowered his arms, the other man started down the catwalk to the laboratory. Renfrew had a sudden memory of his college days at Oxford. He had been walking down a corridor which gave back the hollow, ringing echo only stonework can. It was a beautiful October morning, and he was brimming with eagerness to begin this new life he had looked forward to, the goal of the long student years. He had known he was bright. Here among his intellectual equals, he would at last find his niche. He had come in on the train from York the night before, and now he wanted to get out into the morning sun and take it all in. There were two of them, sauntering towards him down the corridor. They wore their short academic gowns like courtiers' robes, and they walked as though they owned the building. They were talking loudly as they approached him, and looked him over as if he were an Irishman. As they passed him, one said with a lazy drawl, "Oh God, another bloody yokel up on a scholarship." It had set the tone of his years at Oxford. He had got a first, of course, and he had made his name now in the physics world, but he had always felt that even if they were wasting their time, they were enjoying life more than he ever could. The memory of it stung again as he watched Peterson walk towards him. At this distance in time, he could not remember the faces of those two undergraduate snobs, and there was probably no physical resemblance. But this man wore the same graceful, arrogant self-assurance. Also, he noticed the way Peterson dressed, and he resented noticing another man's clothes. Peterson was tall and lean and dark-haired. At a distance, he gave the impression of a young and athletic dandy. He walked lightly, not like the rugby player that Renfrew had been in his youth, but like a tennis or polo player, or perhaps even a javelin thrower. Seen closer, he looked to be in his early 40s, and was, unmistakably, a man used to wielding power. He was handsome in a rather severe way. There was no contempt in his expression, but Renfrew thought bitterly that he had probably just learned to hide it in his adult years. "Pull yourself together, John," he admonished himself silently. "You're the expert, not him. And smile." "Good morning, Dr. Renfrew." The smooth voice was just what he had expected. "Good morning, Mr. Peterson," he murmured, holding out a large, square hand. "Pleased to meet you." Damn, why had he said that? He might almost have been his father's voice. "Amory, pleased to meet you, lad." He was getting paranoid. There was nothing in Peterson's face to indicate anything but seriousness about his job. "Is this the experiment?" Peterson looked round with a remote expression. "Yes, would you like to see it first?" "Please." They passed some old grey cabinets of English manufacture and some newer equipment housed in brightly coloured compartments from Tektronics Physics International and other American firms. These garish red and yellow units came from the small council appropriation. Renfrew led Peterson to a complex array housed between the poles of a large magnet. "Superconducting setup, of course. We need the high field strength to get a nice sharp line during transmission." Peterson studied the maze of wires and meters. Cabinets housing rank upon rank of electronics towered over them. He pointed out a particular object and asked its function. "Oh, I didn't think you'd be wanting to know much of the technical side," Renfrew said. "Try me." "Well, we've got a large indium antimonide sample in there, see?" Renfrew pointed at the encased volume between the magnet poles. "We hit it with high-energy ions. When the ions strike the indium, they give off tachyons. It's a complex, very sensitive ion-nuclei reaction." He glanced at Peterson. "Tachyons are particles that travel faster than light, you know. On the other side..." He pointed around the magnets, leading Peterson to a long blue cylindrical tank that protruded 10 meters away from the magnets. "We draw out the tachyons and focus them into a beam. They have a particular energy and spin, so they resonate only with indium nuclei in a strong magnetic field." "And when they hit something in the way?"
Well, that's the point, Renfrew said sharply. Tachyons have to strike a nucleus in precisely the correct state of energy and spin before they lose any energy in the process. They pass right through ordinary matter. That's why we can shoot them across light years without having them scattered out of their path. Peterson said nothing. He scowled at the equipment. But when one of our tachyons strikes an indium nucleus in precisely the right state, a situation that doesn't occur naturally very often, it'll be absorbed. That tips the spin of the indium nucleus away from wherever it was pointing. Think of the indium nucleus as a little arrow that gets knocked to the side. If all the little arrows were pointing in one direction before the tachyons arrived, then they would get disordered. That would be noticeable, and I see, Peterson said disdainfully. Renfrew wondered if he had overdone that bit about little arrows. It would be fatal if Peterson thought he was talking down to him, which of course he was. That's some other fellow's indium, I suppose. Renfrew held his breath. This was the tricky part. Yes, an experiment operating in the year 1963, he said slowly. Peterson said dryly, I read the preliminary report. These prelims are often deceptive, but I understood that. The technical staff tell me it makes sense, but I can't believe some of the things you've written. This business of altering the past. Look, there's this fellow Markham coming. He'll put you straight on that. If he can. Right. See, the reason nobody's ever tried to send messages back is an obvious one, once you think of it. We can build a transmitter, see, but there's no receiver. Nobody in the past ever built one. Peterson frowned. Well, of course, Renfrew went on enthusiastically. We've built one, naturally, to do our preliminary experiments, but the people back in 1963 didn't know about tachyons, so the trick is to interfere with something they're already doing. That's the ticket. We try to concentrate bursts of tachyons and aim them just so... Hold on, Peterson said, putting up a hand. Aim for what? Where is 1963? Well, quite far away, as it works out. Since 1963, the Earth's been going round the Sun, while the Sun itself is revolving round the hub of the galaxy and so on. Add that up and you find 1963 is pretty distant. Relative to what? Well, relative to the centre of mass of the local group of galaxies, of course. Mind the local group is moving too, relative to the frame of reference provided by the microwave radiation background. And look, skip the jargon, can't you? You're saying 1963 is in the sky somewhere. Quite so. We send out a beam of tachyons to hit that spot. We sweep the volume of space occupied by the Earth at that particular time. Sounds impossible. Renfrew measured his words. I think not. The trick is creating tachyons with essentially infinite speed. Peterson made a wry, tired smile. Ah, essentially infinite. Comic technical talk. I mean, with unmeasurably high velocity, Renfrew said precisely. Sorry for the terminology, if that's what bothers you. Well, look, I'm only trying to understand. Yes, sorry, I may have jumped the gun there. Renfrew visibly composed himself for a fresh attack. Mind, the essential trick here is to get these high-velocity tachyons. Then if we can hit the right spot in space, we can send a message back quite a way. These tachyon beams will go straight through a star. Renfrew frowned. We don't know, actually. There's a possibility that other reactions between these tachyons and other nuclei besides indium will be fairly strong. There's no data on those cross-sections yet. If there are, a planet or a star getting in the way could be trouble. But you've tried simpler tests. I read in the report. Yes, they've been very successful. Well, still, Peterson gestured at the maze of equipment. This strikes me as a fine physics sort of experiment. Commendable, but... He shook his head. Well, I'm amazed you got the money for this. Renfrew's face tightened. It's not all that bloody much. Peterson sighed. Look here, Dr. Renfrew. I'll be frank with you. I'm down here to evaluate this for the Council because
Some pretty big names have said it makes some sort of sense. I don't feel I have the technical background to evaluate this properly. No one on the council has. We're ecologists and biologists and systems people, for the most part.
Should be broader based.
Granted, yes. Our idea in the past has been to bring in specialists as they're needed.
Gruffly.
So Rich Davies at King's College in London. He's keen on this, and there isn't time for that. We're looking for emergency measures.
Renfrew said slowly.
It's that bad.
Peterson paused as though he'd given away too much.
Yes, look, sir. I can move fast, if that's your idea,
Renfrew said briskly.
You may have to.
It would be better if we got a whole new generation of equipment in here.
Renfrew took in the lab with a hand wave.
The Americans have developed new electronics gear that would improve matters. To be really sure we've got through, we need the Americans to come in. Most of the circuitry I need is being developed in their national labs, Brookhaven and so on.
Peterson nodded.
So your report said. That's why I want this fellow Markham in on this today. Has he got the necessary weight to swing it?
I think so. He's well thought of, I'm told, and he's an American on the spot. That's what his National Science Foundation needs to cover itself in case...
Ah, I see. Well, Markham's due here any time now. Come and have some coffee in my office.
Peterson followed him into the cluttered den. Renfrew cleared books and papers off a chair, bustling about in that nervous manner people have when they've suddenly realized, along with a guest, that their office is messy. Peterson sat down, lifting his trousers at the knees and then crossing his legs. Renfrew made more of a business than necessary out of fetching the acrid-smelling coffee because he wanted time to think. Things were starting badly. Renfrew wondered if the memories from Oxford had soured him automatically on Peterson. Well, there was nothing for it. Everyone was fairly edgy these days, anyway. Perhaps Markham could smooth things over when he arrived. Chapter 2 Marjorie locked the kitchen door behind her and walked round the side of the house carrying a bucket of chicken feed. The lawn behind the house was crisply quartered by brick paths with a sundial at the intersection. From force of habit, she followed the path and did not step on the wet grass. Beyond the lawn was a formal rose garden, her own pet project. As she walked through it, breaking beaded spider webs with her body, she stopped here and there to pinch off a dead bloom or to sniff at a bud. It was early in the year, but a few roses were blossoming already. She talked to each bush as she passed it.
Charlotte Armstrong, you're doing very well. Look at all those buds. You're going to be absolutely beautiful this summer. Tiffany, how are you? I see some green fly on you. I'll have to spray you. Good morning, Queen Elizabeth. You're looking very healthy, but you're sticking out rather too far into the path. I should have pruned you more on this side.
Somewhere in the distance, she could hear a knocking sound. It alternated with the trill of a blue tit perched on the hedge. With a start, she realized that the knocking was coming from her own house. It couldn't be Heather or Linda. They would come round the back. She turned. Raindrops splattered from the leaves as she brushed past the rose bushes. She hurried across the lawn and round the side of the house, setting the bucket down by the kitchen door. A shabbily dressed woman with a pitcher in her hand was turning away from the front door. She looked as though she had camped all night. Her hair was matted, and there were smudges on her face. She was about Marjorie's height, but thin and round-shouldered. Marjorie hesitated. So did the woman. They eyed each other across the U-shaped sweep of the gravel drive. Then Marjorie moved forward.
Good morning. She was about to say, can I do something for you?
But held back, uncertain as to whether she wanted to do anything for this woman or not.
Morning, miss. Could you lend me a bit of milk, do you think? I'm all out of milk and the kids haven't had their breakfast yet.
Her manner was confident, but somehow not cordial. Marjorie narrowed her eyes.
Where are you from? She asked.
We just moved into the old farm down the road. Just a little milk, lady.
The woman moved closer to her, holding out the pitcher.
The old farm. But that's derelict, Marjorie thought. There must be squatters.
Her uneasiness increased.
Why do you come here? The shops are open at this time of day. There's a farm along the road, you know, where you can buy milk. Come on, lady. You wouldn't make me walk miles while the little ones are waiting, would you? I'll let you have it back. Don't you believe me?
No, Marjorie thought. Why hadn't the woman gone to one of her own kind? There were some little council houses just a few yards beyond her grounds.
I'm sorry, she said firmly, but I haven't got any to spare.
They confronted each other for a moment. Then the woman turned towards the shrubbery.
Here, Rog, she called.
A tall, gaunt man emerged from the rhododendrons, tugging a small boy by the hand. With an effort, Marjorie kept herself from showing any alarm. She stood stiffly, her head a little back, trying to look in control of the situation. The man shuffled over to stand next to the woman. Marjorie's nostrils flared slightly as she caught a sour odour of sweat and smoke. He was wearing an assortment of clothes that must have come from many different sources. A cloth cap, a long striped college scarf, woolen gloves with all the fingers unravelled, a pair of jaunty blue espadrilles with one sole flapping, trousers that were several inches too short and too wide, and incongruously, a lavishly embroidered waistcoat under a dusty old vinyl jacket. He was probably about Marjorie's age, but looked at least 10 years older. His face was leathery, his eyes deep-set, and he had several days' growth of stubble on his chin. She was aware of the contrast she made with them, standing there, plump and well-fed, her short hair fluffy from washing, her skin protected by creams and lotions, in what she called her old gardening clothes, a soft blue wool skirt, a hand-knit sweater, and a sheepskin jacket.
"You expect us to believe you don't have no milk in the house, lady?" the man growled.
"I didn't say that." Marjorie's voice was clipped. "I have enough for my own family, but no more. There are plenty of other houses down there you could try, but I suggest you go into the village and buy some. It's only half a mile. I'm sorry, I can't help you."
"Like hell you are. You just don't want to. Stack up like all you rich types. You want to keep it all for yourselves. Look what you got. Great big house just for you, I'll bet. You don't know how hard life is for us. I haven't had a job for 4 years and nowhere to live, while you had it soft. Rog," the woman said warningly.
She laid a restraining hand on his arm. He shook it off and moved a step closer to Marjorie. She held her ground, and anger surged in her.
What right did they have to come here and shout at her, dammit, in her own garden? "I've already told you I only have enough for my own family. These are hard times for everyone," she said coldly. But I would never go begging, she thought. No moral backbone, these people.
The man moved closer. Instinctively, she stepped back, maintaining the space between them.
"Hard times for everyone," he said, mimicking her accent. "Just too bad, ain't it? Too bad for everyone else, just so long as you have a nice house and food, and maybe a car too, and a telly."
His eyes were raking the house, taking in the garage, the TV antenna on the roof, the windows. Thank God the windows were locked, she thought, and the front door.
"Look, I can't help you. Will you please go?"
She turned and started to walk back round the house. The man kept pace with her, the woman and child following silently.
"Yes, that's right. Just turn your back on us and go on into your big house. You won't get rid of us that easy. The day's coming when you'll have to get down off that bloody...
I thank you to...
That's it, Rog.
You can't have had it all their own way. There'll be a revolution, and then you'll be begging for help. You think you'll get it? Not bloody likely."
Marjorie increased her pace until it was almost a trot, trying to shake him off before she reached the kitchen door. She was fumbling in her pocket for the key when he came up close behind her. Afraid that he would touch her, she whirled round and faced him.
"Get out of here. Go, don't come bothering me. Go to the authorities. Get off my land."
The man fell back a step. She seized the bucket of chicken feed, not wanting to leave anything out that he might steal.
The key turned easily, thank God, and she slammed the door just as he came up on the step. She snapped the lock home. He shouted through the door.
You bleeding stuck-up tot! Don't fucking care if we starve, do you?
Marjorie began to shake all over, but she shouted back, I'm going to call the police if you don't leave at once. She walked through the house, eyeing the windows. They would be so easy to break. She felt vulnerable, trapped in her own house. Her breathing was very fast and shallow now. She felt nauseated. The man was still shouting outside, his language becoming more and more obscene. The phone was on the hall table. She picked it up and held it to her ear. Nothing. She pressed the receiver bar up and down a few times. Nothing. Damn, 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 what a time for it to go out. It happened often, of course, but not now, please, she prayed. She shook the phone. Still silence. She was completely cut off. What if the man broke in? Her mind raced over potential weapons. The poker, the kitchen knives. Oh, God, no. Better not start any violence. There were two of them, and the man looked a nasty customer. No, she would go out the back, through the French windows in the living room, run to the village for help. She couldn't hear him shouting any longer, but was afraid to show herself at the window to see if he was still there. She tried the phone again. Still nothing. She slammed it down. She focused her attention on the doors and windows, listening for sounds of a break-in. Then the knocking started again at the front door. It was a relief to know where he was and that he was still outside. She waited, gripping the edge of the hall table. Go away, damn you, she willed him. The knocking repeated. After a pause, steps crunched on the gravel. Was he going away at last? And then there was a knock at the kitchen door. Oh, Christ, how could she get rid of him? Marjorie? Hello, Marjorie, are you there? A voice hailed her. Relief flooded her, and she felt close to tears. She was too limp to move. Marjorie, where are you? The voice was moving away. She straightened up and went to the kitchen door and opened it. Her friend Heather was moving off towards the garden shed. Heather? She called. I'm here.
Heather turned and came back to her.
Whatever's the matter? You look awful, she said. Marjorie stepped outside and looked around. Has he gone? She asked. There was a dreadful man here. A shabby-looking man with a woman and child. They were just leaving when I came. What happened? He wanted to borrow some milk.
She started to laugh a little hysterically.
It sounded so ordinary. And then he got rude and started shouting. They're squatters, moved into that empty farm down the road last night. She sank into a kitchen chair. God, that was scary, Heather. I believe it. You look quite shaken. Not like you, Marjorie. I thought you could handle anything, even fierce and dangerous squatters. She had adopted a bantering tone, and Marjorie responded to it. Well, I could, of course. I was going to bash him over the head with a poker and then stick him with a kitchen knife, if he broke in. She was laughing, but it wasn't funny. Had she actually thought of doing that?
Chapter 3. Fall, 1962. He had to find a way to get rid of the damn noise in the experiment. Gordon thought moodily, picking up his scuffed briefcase. The damn stuff wouldn't go away. If he couldn't find the difficulty and correct it, then the whole experiment ended up sucking wind. The palm tree still stopped him every time. Each morning after Gordon Bernstein had slammed the yellow front door of the bungalow a little too loudly, he turned and looked at the palm tree and stopped. The pause was a moment of recognition. He was really here. In California. Not a movie set, the real thing. The palm tree silhouette thrust spearing fronds into a cloudless sky, silently exotic. This matter-of-fact plant was far more impressive than the strangely blank freeways or the unrelentingly balmy weather. Most evenings, Gordon sat up late with Penny, reading and listening to folk records. Things were exactly like his years at Columbia. He kept the same habits and very nearly forgot that half a block away was Windensea Beach with its rolling surf. When he left his windows open, the rumble of the waves seemed like the traffic noise on Second Avenue, a distant blur of other people's lives that he had always successfully avoided there in his apartment. So it came as a small shock each morning when he ventured out, jiggling his car keys nervously, mind mumbling away to itself, and the palm tree yanked him back into this new reality. Weekends, it was easier to remember that this was California. Then he would wake to see Penny's long blonde hair fanned out over the pillow beside him. During the week, she had early classes and left while he was still asleep. She moved so lightly and quietly that she never disturbed him. Each morning, it was as though she had never been there. She left nothing lying around. There wasn't even a dent in the bed where she had slept. Gordon slipped the tinkling keys into his pocket and walked along the bottle brush hedge and out onto the broad boulevards of La Jolla. This, too, was a little strange to him. The streets had ample room to park his 58 Chevy and leave immense stretches of concrete for the two center lanes. The streets were as big as the building lots. They seemed to define the landscape like vast recreation grounds for the dominant species, automobiles. Compared to Second Avenue, which was more like a ventilating shaft between slabs of brown brick, this was extravagant excess. In New York, Gordon had always braced himself when he went down the steps, knowing that when he pushed open the front door of wired glass, there would be dozens of people within sight. They would be briskly moving along, a churn of lives. He could always count on that press of flesh around him. Here, nothing. Nautilus Street was a flat, white plain baking in the morning sun, unpeopled. He climbed into his Chevy, and the roar of starting the engine cracked the silence, seeming to conjure up in his rearview mirror a long, low Chrysler which came over the rise a block away and went by, making a swishing noise. On the way to the campus, he drove with one hand and spun the radio dial with the other, rummaging through the discordant blocks of sound that passed for pop music out here. He preferred folk music, really, but had an odd affection for some old Buddy Holly songs, and lately had found himself humming them in the shower. Every day it's a-getting closer. Well, that'll be the day. He found a high-pitched Beach Boys number and let the dial rest. The tenor warblings about sand and sun described perfectly the travelogue views that swept by outside. He coasted down La Jolla Boulevard and watched the distant small dots that were riding in on a slowly broadening fan of white surf. Kids, unaccountably not in school, even though classes had started 2 weeks ago. He swooped down the hillside and into a pack of slowed cars, mostly big black Lincolns and Cadillacs. He eased down on the brake and noticed new buildings on Mount Soledad. The earth was scraped raw and terraced, trucks climbing over the ruined soil like insects. Gordon smiled tartly, knowing that even if he unsnarled the experiment and produced a brilliant result and got tenure and therefore made a higher salary, he still could not afford the cedar and glass homes that would slant out from that hillside. Not unless he took on a lot of consulting on the side and rose quickly at the university to boot, perhaps wangling his way into a part-time deanship to boost the monthly check. But that was unlikely as hell. He grimaced behind his thick black beard, shifted the Chevy's gears as the Beach Boys faded into a dirt's out, tide's in jingle, and the car surged through traffic with a rich, throaty growl toward the University of California at La Jolla.
This ends side one of cassette one. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.